Fido, a dialogue of Echecrates with Phaedo.
Were you there yourself, Phaedo, with Socrates on the day he drank the poison in the prison, or did you hear about it from someone else?
I was there myself, Echecrates.
Then what did the man say before his death, and how did he die? I would love to hear it. Hardly any of our Phlygian citizens travel to Athens these days, and no visitor has come from there in a long while who could give us any clear report about it, except that he drank poison and died. Beyond that, nobody could tell us anything.
So you didn't even learn how the trial went?
Yes, someone did report that to us, and we were surprised that he apparently died so long after it was over. Why was that, Phaedo?
A stroke of chance in his case, Echecrates. It happened that on the day before the trial, the stern of the ship the Athenians send to Delos was wreathed.
What ship is that?
It's the ship, so the Athenians say, in which Theseus once sailed to Crete with those famous 14 young people, and saved them and saved himself too. The story goes that they vowed to Apollo then that if they were saved, they would send a sacred mission to Delos every year, and ever since, right up to now, they send it to the god annually. Once the mission begins, they have a law that the city must stay pure during that time, and no one may be publicly executed until the ship reaches Delos and comes back again. Sometimes that takes a long while when winds happen to hold them back. The mission begins when the priest of Apollo wreathes the stern of the ship, and that, as I say, happened to occur on the day before the trial. That's why Socrates spent so long in prison between his trial and his death.
But what about the death itself, Phaedo? What was said and done, and which of the man's close friends were with him? Or wouldn't the authorities allow anyone in? Did he die with no friends beside him?
Not at all. There were people with him, quite a few in fact.
Then please do your best to tell us the whole thing as exactly as you can, unless you happen to be pressed for time.
No, I'm free, and I'll try to tell you the story. Remembering Socrates, whether I'm speaking of him myself or listening to someone else, is always the greatest pleasure I have.
Well, Phaedo, you have listeners who feel the same way, so try to go through it all as precisely as you can.
I can tell you, what I felt while I was there was extraordinary. I felt no pity, though I was present at the death of a close friend, because the man seemed happy to me, Echecrates, in his bearing and in his words, so fearlessly and nobly did he meet his end. It struck me that even in going down to Hades he was not going without divine favor, and that when he arrived there he would fare well if anyone ever has. For that reason nothing like grief came over me, as you'd expect for someone present at a scene of mourning, but no pleasure either of the kind we usually had when we were doing philosophy together, though the conversation was of that sort. Instead, I had a genuinely strange feeling, an unfamiliar blend mixed from pleasure and pain together, as I kept thinking that in a moment this man was going to die. And nearly all of us there were in the same state, sometimes laughing, sometimes in tears, one of us especially, Apollodorus. You know the man, I suppose, and what he's like.
Of course I do.
Well, he was completely overcome, and I was shaken myself, and so were the others.
Who happened to be there, Phaedo?
Of the local men, this Apollodorus was there, and Critobulus and his father, and also Hermogenes, Epigenes, Aeschines, and Antisthenes. Ctesippus of Paeania was there too, and Menexenus and some other locals. Plato, I believe, was ill.
Were any foreigners present?
Yes, Simmias the Theban, and Cebes and Phaedons, and from Megara, Euclides and Terption.
What about Aristippus and Cleombrotus? Were they there?
No, they were said to be in Aegina.
Anyone else?
I think those were about all who came.
Well then, what do you say the conversation was?
I'll try to tell you everything from the beginning. On the previous days, the others and I had made a habit of visiting Socrates, gathering at dawn at the courthouse where the trial had been held, since it was near the prison. We would wait around each day until the prison opened, passing the time with one another because it didn't open early, and when it did open, we would go into Socrates and usually spend the whole day with him. On that day we gathered earlier than usual, because the evening before when we left the prison, we had learned that the ship had arrived from Delos. So we passed the word to each other to come as early as possible to the usual place. We came, and the doorkeeper who usually answered to us came out and told us to wait and not go in until he himself gave the word, because the 11, he said, are unchaining Socrates and giving instructions for him to die today. He didn't keep us long, though. He came back and told us to go in. When we entered, we found Socrates just released from his chains, and Xanthippe, you know her, sitting beside him with his little boy on her lap. When Xanthippe saw us, she cried out and said the sort of thing women always do. Socrates, this is the last time your friends will speak to you and you to them. Socrates glanced at Crito and said, Crito, have someone take her home. And some of Crito's people led her away, wailing and beating her breast. Socrates sat up on the bed, bent his leg, and rubbed it with his hand, and as he rubbed it, he said, What a strange thing it seems to be, men, this thing people call pleasant. How remarkably it's related to what seems to be its opposite, the painful. The two of them refuse to visit a person at the same time, yet if you chase one and catch it, you're pretty much forced to take the other too, as if the pair of them were attached at a single head. I think, he said, that if Aesop had noticed this, he would have composed a fable about it. The god wanted to reconcile them in their war, and when he couldn't, he fastened their heads together. And that's why wherever one of them turns up, the other follows along behind. Just as it seems with me. There was pain in my leg from the chain, and now here comes pleasure, evidently following right after it. Sebes broke in. By Zeus, Socrates, I'm glad you reminded me. About those poems you've composed, setting Aesop's fables to verse, and the hymn to Apollo, several people have already asked me, and Evenus did just the other day. What were you thinking, writing them after you came here, when you'd never written anything before? So if you care at all that I have an answer for Evenus when he asks me again, and I know very well he will, tell me what to say. Tell him the truth, Sebes, he said. I didn't write them wanting to rival him or his poems. I knew that wouldn't be easy, but to test what certain dreams meant, and to clear my conscience, in case this was the music they had been ordering me all along to make. It was like this. The same dream kept visiting me throughout my past life, appearing now in one form, now in another, but always saying the same thing. Socrates, it said, make music and work at it. And in the time before now, I took it to be urging and cheering me on in exactly what I was already doing. The way people cheer on runners. That the dream was encouraging me in what I was doing, to make music, since philosophy is the greatest music, and that was what I was practicing. But now, after the trial was over and the gods' festival was delaying my death, it seemed to me that in case the dream had been ordering me all along to make music in the common sense, I ought not to disobey it but should do it. It was safer not to depart before clearing my conscience by composing poems in obedience to the dream. So first I composed one for the god whose festival this was, and after the god, reflecting that a poet, if he's really to be a poet, must make stories and not arguments, and that I was no storyteller myself. I took the stories I had at hand and knew by heart, Aesop's, and versified the first ones I came across. So tell Evenus that Sebes and tell him farewell, and if he's sensible, to follow me as quickly as he can. I'm off today, it seems, the Athenians command it. And Simmias said, What a thing to urge on Evenus, Socrates. I've met the man often, and from what I've seen of him, he won't be at all willing to take your advice. What? He said. Isn't Evenus a philosopher? I think so, said Simmias. Then Evenus will be willing, and so will everyone who engages in this business worthily. But he probably won't do violence to himself. They say that isn't permitted. As he said this, he lowered his legs to the ground, and sitting that way he carried on the rest of the conversation. Then Sebes asked him, What do you mean, Socrates, that it isn't permitted to do violence to oneself, but the philosopher would be willing to follow the dying? Why, Sebes, haven't you and Simmias heard about such things? You studied with Philolaus? Nothing definite, Socrates. Well, I speak of it only from hearsay myself, but what I happen to have heard I don't mind telling. Indeed, it's probably most fitting for someone about to travel to that other place to inquire and tell stories about the journey there, what sort of thing we imagine it to be. What else would one do with the time until sunset? Then on what possible ground do they say it isn't permitted to kill oneself, Socrates? I have indeed heard, to answer the question you just asked, both from Philolaus when he was living with us, and from certain others as well, that one ought not to do this. But I've never heard anything definite about it from anyone. Well, you must be eager to hear it, he said, and perhaps you'll get your wish. Though it may strike you as strange that this alone, of all things, should be simple, that it is never the case for a human being, as it is for other things, that sometimes and for some people it's better to be dead than alive, and yet for those for whom it's better to be dead, it seems it would be wrong for them to do themselves this good turn, and instead they must wait for someone else to do it for them. And Cebes, laughing quietly, said, in his own dialect Zeus knows. And Socrates said, put that way, it certainly sounds unreasonable, and yet perhaps there's some sense in it after all. There's a doctrine spoken of in secret about this, that we human beings are in a kind of guard post, and one must not release oneself from it or run away. That idea seems weighty to me and not easy to see through. Still, this much seems right to me, Cebes, that the gods are the ones who look after us, and that we humans are among the gods' possessions. Doesn't that seem so to you? It does to me, said Cebes. Well then, he said, if one of your own possessions killed itself, without your having indicated that you wanted it dead, wouldn't you be angry with it and punish it if you had some means of punishment? Certainly, he said. Then perhaps, in that light, it isn't unreasonable to say that no one should kill himself before a god sends some necessity upon him, such as the one now present for us. Well, that does seem plausible, Cebes said. But what you were just saying, that philosophers would readily be willing to die, that seems odd, Socrates, if what we just agreed makes sense. That God is the one looking after us, and we are his possessions. For it makes no sense that the most sensible people wouldn't be upset at leaving this service, in which they are overseen by the best overseers there are among beings, the gods. Surely such a person doesn't think he'll take better care of himself once set free. No, a foolish person might think that one should flee from one's master, without reasoning that one shouldn't flee from what is good, but should stay with it as much as possible, so that fleeing would be thoughtless of him. But a sensible person would surely want always to be with what is better than himself. And so, Socrates, it seems the opposite of what you were just saying should be true. It's fitting for the sensible to be upset at dying, and for the foolish to rejoice. When Socrates heard this, he seemed to me pleased with Cebes' persistence, and glancing at us he said, Cebes is always hunting down some argument or other, and he's not at all quick to be convinced by whatever anyone says. And Simmias said, well, Socrates, this time I think Cebes actually has a point. What could truly wise men want, in fleeing from masters better than themselves, and getting free of them so easily? And I think Cebes is aiming his argument at you, that you take it so lightly, leaving both us and those good rulers you yourself admit are gods. You're right to say so, he said. I take it you mean I ought to make a defense against this, as if in a courtroom. Exactly, said Simmias. Come then, he said, let me try to make my defense more persuasive to you than it was to the jury. For he said, Simmias and Cebes, if I didn't expect to arrive first among other gods both wise and good, and then among human beings who have died who are better than the ones here, I'd be wrong not to be upset at death. But as it is, you may be sure I expect to arrive among good men, though I wouldn't insist too strongly on that, but that I will arrive among gods who are altogether good masters. This, if anything of the kind, I would insist on firmly. So that's why I'm not equally troubled, and instead I'm full of hope that there is something for those who have died. And as the old saying goes, something far better for the good than for the wicked. Well then, Socrates, said Simmias, do you intend to keep this thought to yourself as you go, or would you share it with us too? It seems to me this would be a good shared by us as well, and at the same time it would serve as your defense if you persuade us of what you're saying. I'll try, he said. But first let's see what Crito here wants. He seemed to want to say something for a while now. What else, Socrates, said Crito, except what the man who's going to give you the poison has been telling me for a while now, that you should be told to talk as little as possible. He says people get more heated when they talk, and nothing like that should interfere with the drug. Otherwise, those who do that sort of thing sometimes have to drink it 2 or even 3 times. And Socrates said, let him be. Just let him prepare his dose so it can be given 2 or even 3 times if need be. I pretty much knew you'd say that, said Crito, but he's been bothering me about it for a while. Let him be, he said. Well then, I want to give my defense now to you, my judges, to show why it seems reasonable to me that a man who has genuinely spent his life in philosophy should be confident as he faces death, and full of hope that once he dies, he will gain the greatest goods over there. How this could be so, Simmias and Cebes, I'll try to explain. It seems that those who engage with philosophy in the right way happen, without others noticing, to be practicing nothing other than dying and being dead. So if this is true, it would surely be strange to be eager, throughout one's whole life, for nothing but this. And then, when it actually arrives, to be upset about the very thing one had long been eager for and practicing. And Simmias laughed and said, by Zeus, Socrates, you've made me laugh just now, though I wasn't really in the mood. I think most people, hearing that, would think it very well said about those who practice philosophy, and our own countrymen would agree entirely, that philosophers really do long for death, and that it hasn't escaped them that they deserve it. And they'd be right to say so, Simmias, except for the part about it not escaping them. For it has escaped them in what sense the true philosophers long for death, and in what sense they deserve it, and what sort of death it is. Let's speak among ourselves, he said, and pay no more attention to them. Do we think death is something? Certainly, said Simmias, taking up the question. Is it anything other than the separation of the soul from the body? And that being dead is this. The body having come to be by itself, separated from the soul, and the soul being by itself, separated from the body. Is death anything other than this? No, this is it, he said. Consider then, my good man, whether you agree with me on this, for I think it's from this that we'll get more insight into what we're examining. Does it seem fitting for a philosopher to be seriously concerned with the pleasures people call such, for instance those of food and drink? Least of all, Socrates, said Simmias. And what about the pleasures of sex? Not at all. And what about the other kinds of bodily care and adornment? Does such a man think them worth honoring? Things like fine clothes and shoes and other bodily ornaments. Does he seem to you to value them or to despise them, except so far as there's great necessity to have anything to do with them? I think the true philosopher despises them, he said. Doesn't it seem to you then that such a man's whole concern is not with the body, but so far as he can, turned away from it and toward the soul? It does to me. So doesn't the philosopher show himself, first of all in matters like these, as releasing his soul from association with the body, more than other people do? So it appears. And most people think, Simmias, that someone for whom none of these things is pleasant, who takes no part in them, doesn't deserve to live, that a man who cares nothing for the pleasures that come through the body is close to being dead already. Quite true what you say. But what about the acquisition of understanding itself? Is the body a hindrance or not, if one takes it along as a partner in the search? Here's what I mean. Do sight and hearing hold any truth for human beings, or is it just as the poets are always chanting to us, that we neither hear nor see anything accurately? And yet if these bodily senses aren't accurate or clear, the others will hardly be better, since they're all inferior to these. Don't you think so? I do, he said. When then does the soul grasp the truth? For whenever it tries to examine anything together with the body, it's clearly deceived by it. True. Isn't it in reasoning, then, if anywhere, that something of the things that are becomes clear to it? Yes. And it reasons best, surely, when none of these things troubles it, neither hearing nor sight, nor pain nor any pleasure. But when it is, as much as possible, alone by itself, letting the body go, and so far as it can, having no association or contact with it, reaches out toward what is. That's so. So here too the philosopher's soul dishonors the body most, and flees from it, seeking to be by itself. It appears so. And what about things like this, Simmias? Do we say there's such a thing as the just itself, or not? We certainly do, by Zeus. And again, something beautiful and something good. Of course. Have you ever yet seen any of these with your eyes? Never, he said. Or grasped them by any other bodily sense. I mean all of them together, size, health, strength, and in one word the being of each thing, what each really is. Is their truest reality contemplated through the body? Or is it rather this way? Whoever among us prepares himself most fully and precisely to think through, in itself, the very thing he's investigating, that person will come closest to knowing each thing. Certainly. Would the man who does this most purely, then, be the one who goes at each thing as much as possible with pure thought itself, not laying any sight alongside his thinking, nor dragging in any other sense together with his reasoning, but who uses thought alone by itself, unmixed, and tries to hunt down each of the things that are, each one itself by itself, unmixed, cut off as far as possible from eyes and ears, and so to speak, from the whole body. On the ground that the body throws the soul into confusion and does not let it acquire truth and understanding whenever it keeps it company. Isn't this the man, Simmias, if anyone will, who will lay hold of what is? What you say is extraordinarily true, Socrates, said Simmias. Then, he said, from all this some such belief must arise in men who are genuinely lovers of wisdom, so that they say things like this to one another, that there seems to be a kind of path leading us, together with the argument in our inquiry, that as long as we have the body and our soul is fouled up together with such an evil, we will never adequately gain what we desire, and this, we say, is the truth. For the body fills us with countless distractions just to feed it, and then, if diseases fall upon it, they block our hunt for what is. It fills us with erotic longings and appetites and fears and images of every sort and a great deal of nonsense, so that, as the saying truly goes, no thinking whatsoever ever actually arises in us because of it. Wars, factions, and battles are caused by nothing but the body and its appetites. For all wars come about because of the acquisition of wealth, and we are forced to acquire wealth because of the body, since we are enslaved to its service. And because of all this, we have no leisure for philosophy. And the worst thing of all is that even if we do get some leisure from it and turn to look into something, in our inquiries the body keeps forcing its way in everywhere, causing turmoil and confusion, and it startles us so that we cannot see the truth on account of it. No, it has really been shown to us that if we are ever going to know something purely, we must be rid of the body and view the things themselves with the soul by itself. And then, it seems, we will have what we desire and claim to be lovers of understanding, once we have died, as the argument shows, though not while we are alive. For if it isn't possible to know anything purely in company with the body, then one of two things is true. Either knowledge cannot be acquired anywhere at all, or only after death. For then the soul will be by itself, apart from the body and not before. And while we are alive, it seems, we will be as close as possible to knowing only if we have as little as possible to do with the body and do not share in it, except where absolute necessity requires, and do not let ourselves be infected with its nature, but stay pure of it, until the God himself releases us. And in this way, once we are freed from the body's folly and made pure, we will presumably be in the company of others like ourselves, and will know through ourselves the whole of what is unmixed, and that, perhaps, is the truth. For it is probably not permitted for the impure to touch the pure. Such things, Simmias, I think all who rightly love learning must say and believe among themselves. Or don't you think so? Nothing could be more so, Socrates. Then, said Socrates, if this is true, my friend, there is great hope that when I arrive where I am going, I will there, if anywhere, adequately gain that for the sake of which we have taken such great pains in our past life. So that this journey now laid upon me comes with good hope, and for any other man too who believes his mind has been prepared, as it were, purified. Certainly, said Simmias. And is this not what purification turns out to be? The very thing we've been saying for a while now, separating the soul as much as possible from the body, and habituating it to gather and collect itself together, out of every part of the body by itself, and to dwell, as far as it can, both now and hereafter, alone by itself, released as if from chains from the body. Certainly, he said. And isn't this exactly what is called death, the release and separation of soul from body? Absolutely, he said. And it is always, we say, those who practice philosophy in the right way, and only they who are most eager to release it, and this very thing is the philosopher's pursuit, the release and separation of soul from body. Isn't that so? It appears so. Then, as I was saying at the beginning, wouldn't it be absurd for a man to spend his life preparing himself to live as close as possible to being dead, and then, when death arrives for him, to resent it? Absurd, of course. So in truth, Simmias, he said, those who practice philosophy rightly are practicing dying, and death is, for them, the least fearsome thing in the world of all things. Consider it from the following. If they are everywhere at odds with the body, and desire to have the soul by itself alone, and if when this actually happens, they were to be afraid and resentful, wouldn't it be quite unreasonable of them not to go gladly to the place where, once they arrive, there is hope of attaining what they loved throughout their life, and they loved understanding, and of being rid of that with which they were at odds, now that it no longer accompanies them? Many men, when their human loves, boys, wives, sons, have died, have been willing of their own accord to go down to Hades, driven by just this hope, of seeing there those they longed for and being with them. And yet will someone who is truly in love with understanding, and who has grasped this very same hope firmly, that he will meet with it nowhere else worth mentioning except in Hades, will he resent dying and not go there gladly? We must think he will, my friend, if he is truly a philosopher. For he will be quite convinced of this, that he will meet with understanding in its pure form nowhere else but there. And if this is so, as I was just saying, wouldn't it be quite unreasonable for such a man to fear death? Quite unreasonable indeed, by Zeus, he said. So isn't this, he said, sufficient evidence for you about any man you see resenting the prospect of dying, that he was, after all, no lover of wisdom but a lover of the body? And this same man happens, no doubt, to be a lover of money too, and a lover of honor, one or the other of these, or both. It is certainly as you say, he said. Then, Simmias, he said, doesn't what is called courage belong most of all to men disposed in just this way? Absolutely, surely, he said. And self-control too, the very thing most people call self-control, not being flustered over one's appetites but holding them cheap and in orderly check. Doesn't that belong only to those who hold the body cheapest and live in philosophy? It must, he said. For if you're willing, he said, to consider the courage and self-control of everyone else, they will strike you as strange. How so, Socrates? You know, he said, that everyone else regards death as one of the great evils. Very much so, he said. So isn't it out of fear of greater evils that the courageous among them endure death, whenever they do endure it? That's so. So it is by being afraid, and through fear, that all of them are courageous, except the philosophers. And yet it's absurd for someone to be courageous through fear and cowardice. Quite so. And what about the well-behaved among them? Haven't they suffered the same thing? Are they self-controlled through a kind of self-indulgence? Yet we say that's impossible, but all the same, something like this happens to them regarding this simple-minded self-control. Fearing to be deprived of certain other pleasures, and desiring them, they hold off from some pleasures because they are mastered by others. And yet they call it self-indulgence to be ruled by pleasures. But it turns out that, being mastered by certain pleasures, they master other pleasures. And this is like what was just being said, that in a way it is through self-indulgence that they have been made self-controlled. So it seems. My blessed Simmias, I'm afraid this isn't the right exchange for virtue, trading pleasures for pleasures, pains for pains, and fear for fear, greater for smaller, as if they were coins, but that there is only one currency that is correct, for which all these must be exchanged. Understanding. And with this, and in exchange for this, everything is truly bought and sold, courage and self-control and justice, and in short, true virtue together with understanding, whether pleasures and fears and all other such things are added or taken away. But when they are separated from understanding and exchanged one for another, such virtue is nothing but a kind of sketch, and is in fact slavish, and has nothing sound or true in it. While the truth is really some kind of purification from all such things, and self-control and justice and courage and understanding itself are a kind of purification. And it seems to me that the men who established the rites of initiation for us were no fools, but were, in fact, hinting long ago that whoever arrives in Hades uninitiated and unperfected will lie in the mud, while the one who arrives there purified and perfected will dwell among the gods. For as those concerned with the rites say, many carry the wand, but the bekants are few. And these, in my opinion, are none other than those who have practiced philosophy in the right way. I have done everything in my power in my life to become one of these, leaving nothing undone, and have striven in every way to do so. Whether I have striven rightly, and whether we have achieved anything, we will know clearly, once we arrive there, a little later, God willing, as I believe. This then, Simmias and Sebes, he said, is my defense that it is reasonable for me not to take it hard or resent leaving you and the masters here, believing that there too, no less than here, I will meet with good masters and companions. Most people find this hard to believe. So if I am at all more convincing to you in my defense than I was to the Athenian jurors, that would be good. When Socrates had said this, Sebes took it up and said, Socrates, everything else seems to me well said, but what you say about the soul causes people a great deal of disbelief. The fear that once it is freed from the body, it is no longer anywhere at all, but is destroyed and perishes on that very day a man dies, the moment it is freed from the body. And that as it goes out, it scatters and disperses like breath or smoke, flying off and vanishing, and is no longer anywhere at all. For if it really existed somewhere, gathered together by itself and rid of those evils you were just describing, that would be a great and beautiful hope, Socrates, that what you say is true. But this surely needs no small amount of reassurance and proof, that the soul exists once the man has died, and retains some power and understanding. What you say is true, Sebes, said Socrates. But what shall we do then? Do you want us to talk the matter through together, whether it's likely to be so or not? I, for one, said Sebes, would be glad to hear what view you hold about it. I don't think, said Socrates, that anyone hearing me now, not even if he were a comic poet, could say I am babbling and talking about things that don't concern me. So if you think it best, we should look into it closely. Let's examine it this way, whether the souls of men who have died exist in Hades or not. Now there is an old tradition which we recall, that souls arriving there come from here and then come back here again, and are born from the dead. And if this is so, that the living are born again from the dead, wouldn't our souls have to exist there? For surely they could not be born again if they did not exist, and this would be sufficient proof that this is so, if it should truly become clear that the living come from nowhere else but from the dead. But if this is not so, some other argument would be needed. Quite so, said Sebes. Well then, he said, don't consider this just in the case of human beings if you want to understand it more easily, but in the case of all animals and plants too. And in short, let us look at everything that comes to be, and see whether everything comes to be in this way, from nothing else but from its opposite, in the case of all things that happen to have such a thing. As say, the beautiful is opposite to the ugly, and the just to the unjust, and countless other things are like this. Let us examine this, then. Whether it is necessary that everything that has an opposite comes to be from nothing else but its own opposite. For instance, when something comes to be larger, isn't it necessary that it was smaller before, and only afterward becomes larger?
Yes.
So if something becomes smaller, it must have been bigger before and becomes smaller afterward.
That's how it is, he said.
And the weaker comes from the stronger, and the faster from the slower.
Certainly.
And what about this? If something becomes worse, doesn't it come from something better, and if more just, from something less just?
Of course.
So we have this well enough established, that everything comes to be this way, opposite things from their opposites.
Certainly.
Now then, is there also something like this in them? That between every pair of opposites, since there are two of them, there are two processes of becoming, one from each toward the other, and then back again from that one to the first. Between something bigger and something smaller, there's growth and shrinking, and we call one of these growing, the other shrinking.
Yes, he said. and likewise separating and combining, cooling and heating, and so on for everything, even where we don't have names for it in some cases. Still, in practice, it must hold everywhere that these things come to be out of each other, and there's a process of becoming from each into the other.
Certainly, he said.
Well then, he said, is there something opposite to being alive, the way being awake is opposite to being asleep?
Certainly, he said.
What is it?
Being dead, he said.
So these come from each other, since they're opposites, and there are two processes of becoming between the two of them.
Of course.
Now then, he said, I'll tell you the one pair of opposites I was just talking about, and it's two processes, Socrates said this, and you tell me the other.
I mean sleeping and waking. Waking comes from sleeping, and sleeping comes from waking, and their two processes are falling asleep and waking up.
Is that clear enough for you or not?
Certainly.
Now you tell me the same way about life and death.
Don't you say that being dead is opposite to being alive?
I do.
And that they come from each other?
Yes.
So what comes from the living?
The dead, he said.
And what he said from the dead?
I have to admit, he said, the living.
So living things and living people come from the dead, Sebes.
So it appears, he said.
Then our souls exist in Hades.
It seems so.
And of the two processes involved here, isn't one of them at least perfectly clear?
Dying is clear enough, surely, isn't it?
Certainly, he said.
So what shall we do, he said.
Shall we fail to supply the opposite process, and let nature limp along lopsided this way? Or must we grant some process opposite to dying?
We must surely, he said.
What is it?
Coming back to life.
So he said, if there is such a thing as coming back to life, this would be a process from the dead into the living, this coming back to life.
Certainly.
Then we agree on this too. The living come from the dead no less than the dead come from the living. And given this, it seemed to be sufficient proof that the souls of the dead must exist somewhere, from which they come back again.
I think, Socrates, he said, that this follows necessarily from what we've agreed.
Now look at it this way, Sebes, he said, and see that we haven't agreed to this unfairly as I see it. Suppose things didn't always pay each other back this way, one becoming from the other in a circle, but instead there were a straight-line process going only one way, from one thing to its opposite, without ever bending back or curving around. You realize that in the end everything would take on the same form and suffer the same fate, and becoming would stop altogether.
What do you mean?
He said.
It's not hard to grasp what I mean, he said. Suppose, for instance, there were falling asleep, but waking up never paid it back by coming from the sleeping thing. You see that in the end everything would make Endymion look like a joke, and he'd be nowhere in particular, because everything else would have suffered the same thing as he did. Sleeping. And if everything combined but nothing ever separated, the state of affairs Anaxagoras describes would quickly come about, all things together. And in the same way, dear Sebes, if everything that had a share of life died, and once dead, the dead things stayed in that condition and never came back to life, wouldn't it be quite inevitable that everything would eventually be dead and nothing alive? Because if living things came from other things, but the living things kept dying, what could possibly prevent everything from being used up in death?
There's no way around it, Socrates, said Sebes. You seem to me to be entirely right.
Yes, Sebes, he said, I think it's absolutely so, and we're not agreeing to this deceived. It really is true that there's such a thing as coming back to life, that the living come from the dead, that the souls of the dead exist, and that it goes better for the good souls and worse for the bad ones.
And what's more, Socrates, said Sebes, taking it up, if that theory is true which you're always saying, that our learning is really nothing but recollection, then by this argument too we must have learned at some earlier time what we're now recollecting.
But that's impossible, unless our soul existed somewhere before it came to be in this human form. So on this count too the soul looks like something immortal.
But Sebes, said Simmias, taking it up, what are the proofs of this?
Remind me, I don't remember them very clearly at the moment.
In one word, said Sebes, and a beautiful one, If you question people properly, they'll tell you all on their own exactly how things stand. And yet if they didn't have knowledge already in them, along with a correct account, they wouldn't be able to do this. And then, if you bring them to diagrams or anything of that sort, right there it becomes perfectly clear that this is so. But if you're not convinced by that, Simmias, said Socrates, see whether you agree looking at it this way instead. Do you doubt how so-called learning could be recollection? It's not that I doubt you, said Simmias, but I need to have this very experience the argument is about, being reminded. And in fact, from what Sebes has started to say, I'm already remembering and I'm convinced, but I'd like to hear all the same how you were going to argue it. Like this, he said. We agree, I take it, that if someone is going to remember something, he must have known it at some earlier time. Certainly, he said. Do we also agree on this, that whenever knowledge comes about in a certain way, it's recollection? What way do I mean? This, if someone, on seeing or hearing something, or getting some other perception of it, doesn't just recognize that thing but also thinks of something else, of which the knowledge is not the same but different, don't we rightly say that he was reminded of the thing he formed a notion of? What do you mean? Something like this. Knowledge of a person is one thing, knowledge of a liar another. Of course. Well, you know what happens to lovers whenever they see a liar, or a cloak, or anything else their beloved is used to using, they recognize the liar. And in their mind, they form the image of the boy whose liar it was. That's recollection, just as someone seeing Simmias is often reminded of Sebes, and there would be countless other examples like that. Countless indeed, by Zeus, said Simmias. So he said, isn't something like that a kind of recollection, especially when it happens to someone regarding things that, through time and inattention, he had already forgotten? Certainly, he said. Well then, he said, is it possible, on seeing a painted horse or a painted lyre, to be reminded of a person, and on seeing a painted Simmias to be reminded of Sebes? Certainly. And also, on seeing a painted Simmias, to be reminded of Simmias himself. That's possible too, he said. So doesn't it follow, in all these cases, that recollection can come both from things that are like the thing recollected, and from things that are unlike it? It does. But whenever someone is reminded of something from things like it, isn't it necessary that he also experience this in addition, noticing whether the thing falls short in its likeness of the thing he was reminded of, or not? Necessarily, he said. Now look, he said, whether this is so. We say there is such a thing as equal. I don't mean a stick equal to a stick, or a stone to a stone, or anything of that kind, but something else beyond all these, the equal itself. Shall we say it's something or nothing? We'll certainly say it's something by Zeus, said Simmias, remarkably so. And do we actually know what it is? Certainly, he said. Where did we get the knowledge of it from? Isn't it from the things we were just talking about, seeing sticks or stones or other things that are equal? We formed the notion of that other thing from these, something different from them. Or doesn't it seem different to you? Look at it this way too. Don't equal stones and sticks sometimes, while remaining the same, appear equal to one person and not to another? Certainly. But now, did the equals themselves ever appear unequal to you, or equality appear as inequality? Never, Socrates. So these equal things are not the same, he said, as the equal itself. It doesn't appear so to me at all, Socrates. And yet, he said, it's from these equal things, different as they are from that equal, that you've nonetheless formed the notion of it and grasped it. That's very true, he said. And this either because it's like them or unlike them. Certainly. It makes no difference, he said, as long as, seeing one thing, you think of another from that sight, whether like or unlike, it must be that this has become an act of recollection. Certainly. Well then, he said, do we experience something like this with the equal things in sticks and the like that we were just talking about? Do they appear to us to be equal in the way the equal itself is? Or do they fall short of being such a thing as the equal, or not at all? They fall quite short, he said. So don't we agree that whenever someone, seeing something, thinks, This thing I'm now looking at is trying to be like some other thing among the things that are, but falls short and cannot be like that thing, being inferior to it. The person thinking this must already have had prior knowledge of that thing which he says the other resembles, but imperfectly.
Necessarily.
Well then, is this the very experience we've had ourselves, regarding equal things and the equal itself?
Absolutely.
So it's necessary that we knew the equal beforehand. Before that time when we first saw equal things and realized that all of them are straining to be like the equal, but fall short of it.
Yes, that's so.
But we also agree on this, that we couldn't have gotten the notion from anywhere else, nor is it possible to get it any other way except from seeing or touching or some other sense, and I count all the senses as one for this purpose.
They're the same, Socrates, at least for what the argument is trying to show.
Well then, it's from the senses that we must come to realize that everything given in the senses is straining toward that which the equal itself is, and falls short of it.
Isn't that how we put it?
Yes.
So before we began to see and hear and use our other senses, we must somehow have already acquired knowledge of the equal itself, what it is, if we were going to refer the equal things we perceive back to it, on the grounds that they're all eager to be like it but come up short. That follows necessarily from what we've already agreed, Socrates.
But didn't we start seeing and hearing and having our other senses the moment we were born?
Certainly.
And we're saying we had to have gotten knowledge of the equal before that.
Yes.
So it seems we must have possessed it before we were born.
It does seem so.
Now if we acquired it before birth and had it when we came to be, then we knew both before birth and right at birth, not only the equal and the greater and the less, but all things of that kind. For our argument now concerns the beautiful itself and the good itself no less than the equal, and the just and the holy, and as I say, everything we stamp with the seal, what it is, when we ask questions, and when we answer them. So we must have acquired knowledge of all these before we were born.
That's so.
And if, having acquired it, we hadn't each time forgotten it, we'd always be born knowing it and would know it throughout our lives. For this is what knowing is, to have gotten hold of some piece of knowledge and to keep it, not to have lost it.
Isn't that what we mean by forgetting, Simmias, the loss of knowledge?
Certainly, Socrates, he said.
But if, I imagine, we got it before being born and lost it in the process of being born, and then later, by using our senses concerning those very things, we recover the knowledge we once had before, wouldn't what we call learning be the recovery of knowledge that is already our own? And wouldn't we be right to call this remembering?
Quite right.
For it has turned out to be possible, hasn't it, that a person who perceives something, sees it, or hears it, or takes it in through some other sense, can, from that, come to think of something else that had slipped his mind, something related to it though unlike it, or something it resembles. So, as I say, one of two things must be true. Either we're born already knowing these things and know them throughout our lives, or afterward, the people we say are learning are doing nothing but remembering, and learning would just be recollection.
That's certainly how it looks, Socrates.
What do you choose then, Simmias?
That we're born knowing, or that we later recollect what we had come to know earlier.
I can't choose right now, Socrates.
Well, can you choose this and tell me what you think about it? A man who knows something, could he give an account of what he knows or not?
Certainly he must be able to, Socrates.
And do you think everyone can give an account of the things we've just been discussing?
I wish they could, said Simmias. But I'm much more afraid that by this time tomorrow there won't be a single person left able to do it properly.
So you don't think everyone knows these things, Simmias?
Not at all.
So they're remembering what they once learned?
Necessarily.
When did our souls acquire this knowledge?
Not surely since we became human beings.
No, certainly not.
Before that, then?
Yes.
So our souls existed, Simmias, even before they took human form apart from bodies, and they possessed understanding. Unless we acquire this knowledge at the very moment we're born, Socrates, that time is still left open.
Well, my friend, but at what other time do we lose it?
We're not born already having it, as we've just agreed. Do we lose it at the very moment we get it, or can you name some other time?
None at all, Socrates. I didn't notice I was saying nothing.
Well then, is this how it stands for us, Simmias? If those things we're always going on about really exist, the beautiful, the good, and all that kind of reality, and we refer everything we perceive back to that reality, discovering that it existed beforehand and belongs to us, and we compare our perceptions to it, then it follows necessarily that just as these things exist, so too our soul existed before we were born. But if they don't exist, this whole argument would have been made in vain.
Isn't that how it stands? And isn't it equally necessary that these things exist, and that our souls existed before we were born, and that if the one is false, so is the other?
It seems to me, Socrates, said Simmias, that the same necessity holds in both cases, and the argument takes splendid refuge in the fact that our soul's existence before our birth stands or falls together with the reality you're now describing.
There's nothing I find so evident as this, that all such things exist as fully as possible, the beautiful, the good, and all the others you were just naming, and I think it's been adequately demonstrated.
And what about Cebes? Said Socrates.
Cebes has to be persuaded too.
Adequately, I think, said Simmias, though he's the most stubborn of men when it comes to distrusting arguments.
Still, I think he's sufficiently convinced that our soul existed before we were born.
But whether it will still exist once we've died, that, I think, hasn't been shown even to his own satisfaction, Socrates.
The point Cebes raised earlier still stands, the worry most people have, that the soul might scatter the moment a person dies, and that this might be the end of its existence.
What's to stop it from coming into being and being assembled from somewhere else, and existing before it enters a human body? And yet, once it arrives there and departs again, from itself coming to an end and being destroyed.
Well said, Simmias, said Cebes.
It does look as if only half of what needs proving has been shown, that our soul existed before we were born. But it still needs to be shown, in addition, that it will exist just as much after we die as it did before we were born, if the proof is to be complete.
It has been shown, Simmias and Cebes, said Socrates.
Even now, if you're willing to combine this argument with the one we agreed on earlier, that everything living comes from what is dead. For if the soul exists even before this life, and if, in coming to life and being born, it can come from nowhere else but from death and being dead, then surely it must exist after death too, since it has to come to life again.
So what you're asking has already been shown, even now.
Still, I think you and Simmias would enjoy working this argument over still further. You have the fear children have, that when the soul leaves the body the wind will really blow it apart and scatter it, especially if a person happens to die not in calm weather, but in a great storm.
And Cebes laughed and said, talk us out of it, Socrates, as if we were afraid, or rather, not as if we ourselves were afraid, but as if there's a child in each of us who's frightened of such things.
Try to persuade him not to fear death, as if it were a boogeyman.
But you must, said Socrates, chant a charm over him every day until you've charmed the fear away.
But where, Socrates, said Cebes, shall we find a good singer of such charms now that you're leaving us?
Greece is a large place, Cebes, he said, and there are good men in it, and there are many foreign peoples too. You must search through all of them looking for such a charmer, sparing neither money nor effort, since there's nothing on which you could spend your money to better purpose.
And you must search among yourselves as well, for you might not easily find people more capable of doing this than you are.
Well, that we'll see to, said Cebes. But let's go back to where we left off, if that's what pleases you.
Of course it pleases me, why wouldn't it?
Good, he said.
Now, said Socrates, this is the sort of question we need to ask ourselves. What kind of thing is it that suffers this fate, being scattered apart, and what kind of thing should we be afraid might suffer it, and what kind should not? And after that we should examine which kind the soul is, and on that basis feel confident or afraid on our soul's behalf.
That's true, he said.
Now isn't it fitting that whatever is composite, put together out of parts, should by its nature suffer this, being split apart the same way it was put together?
And if something happens to be non-composite, it alone, if anything, is fit not to suffer this.
That's how it seems to me, said Cebes.
And isn't it likely that the things which are always the same and stay in the same state are the non-composite ones, while the things that are sometimes one way and sometimes another, and are never the same are the composite ones?
Yes, that's how it seems to me too.
Let's go back then, he said, to the same things we were discussing before. That reality itself, whose being we account for in our questions and answers, does it always stay the same in the same state, or does it change from one condition to another? The equal itself, the beautiful itself, each thing itself, what it is, being itself, does it ever admit any change whatsoever? Or does each of them, being what it is, single in form, remaining by itself, stay always the same in the same state, and never in any way admit any alteration at all?
It must stay the same, in the same state, Socrates, said Cebes.
But what about the many beautiful things, people or horses or cloaks or anything else of that kind? Or equal things, or beautiful things, or anything sharing the same name as those realities? Do they stay the same, or is it just the opposite with them, that they're never, so to speak, the same as themselves or as each other in any way at all?
These, in turn, said Cebes, are never the same.
Phaedo. So these things you could touch and see and perceive with your other senses. But the things that stay always the same, there's no way to grasp them except by the reasoning of the mind.
They're invisible, not things you see.
What you say is entirely true, he said.
Shall we then posit two kinds of things that are one visible, one invisible?
Let's posit that, he said.
And the invisible always stays the same, the visible never does.
Let's posit that too, he said.
Well then, he went on, aren't we ourselves partly body and partly soul?
Nothing else, he said.
Which of the two kinds would we say the body is more like, more akin to?
That's obvious to everyone, he said, the visible.
And the soul?
Visible or invisible?
Not visible to human eyes, Socrates, he said.
But we meant visible and invisible relative to human nature. Or did you have some other standard in mind?
Human nature.
Then what do we say about the soul, visible or invisible?
Not visible.
Invisible then.
Yes.
So the soul is more like the invisible, and the body more like the visible.
That's altogether necessary, Socrates.
Now didn't we also say a while back that when the soul uses the body to examine something, through sight or hearing or any other sense, since examining something through sense perception is exactly what using the body means, it gets dragged by the body toward things that never stay the same, and it wanders and gets confused and dizzy, as if drunk from contact with things of that sort.
Certainly.
But when it examines things on its own, it travels there to what is pure and everlasting and immortal and unchanging, and being akin to it, it stays with it always, whenever it's on its own and free to be, and it stops wandering, and in the presence of those things it stays constant and unchanging, since it's in contact with things of that sort.
And isn't this condition of the soul called wisdom?
Absolutely, beautifully and truly said, Socrates.
So which kind, going by what we said before and what we're saying now, does the soul seem to you more like, more akin to?
I think anyone, Socrates, even the dullest, would agree, following this line of reasoning, that the soul is altogether and entirely more like the thing that always stays the same than the thing that doesn't.
And the body?
Like the other kind.
Phaedo.
Now look at it this way too. Whenever soul and body are together, nature assigns one to be ruled and enslaved, the other to rule and be master. Judging by that, which one seems to you like the divine and which like the mortal?
Don't you think the divine is naturally suited to rule and lead, while the mortal is suited to be ruled and enslaved?
I do.
Then which does the soul resemble?
Clearly, Socrates, the soul resembles the divine, and the body the mortal.
Then consider, Cebes, he said, whether it follows from everything we've said that the soul is most like the divine, the immortal, the intelligible, the uniform, the indissoluble, and what stays always the same as itself. While the body, on the other hand, is most like the human, the mortal, the multiform, the unintelligible, the dissoluble, and what never stays the same as itself. Can we say anything against that, dear Sebes, to show it isn't so?
We can't.
Well then, given that this is so, isn't it fitting for the body to dissolve quickly, while the soul is entirely indissoluble or close to it?
Of course.
Do you notice then, he said, that when a person dies, the visible part of him, the body lying there in the visible world, what we call a corpse, which is naturally due to dissolve and fall apart and be dispersed, doesn't suffer any of that right away, but stays intact for a good long time, quite a long time in fact, if the person dies with his body in good condition and at a favorable season. Once the body shrinks and is embalmed, like the mummies in Egypt, it stays whole almost indefinitely, and even if some parts decay, the bones and sinews and everything like that are, so to speak, practically immortal, isn't that so?
Yes.
But the soul, the invisible part, which departs to another place of that kind, noble and pure and invisible, truly to Hades, into the presence of the good and wise God, where, God willing, my own soul must soon go too, this soul of ours, so constituted, does it really, the moment it leaves the body, get blown apart and destroyed, as most people claim. Far from it, dear Sebes and Simias, the truth is much more like this. If it departs pure, dragging nothing of the body along with it, since it had no willing part in the body's company during life but fled from it and gathered itself into itself, always practicing just this. And that's nothing other than practicing philosophy rightly, truly training to die with ease, or isn't that exactly what the practice of death would be?
Phado.
Absolutely. Then in that condition it departs to what is like itself, the invisible, the divine, the immortal, the wise, and arriving there it gets to be happy, freed from wandering and folly and fears and wild desires and all the other human troubles. And as they say of the initiated, it truly spends the rest of time in the company of the gods. Shall we say it's like this, Sebes, or otherwise?
Like this, by Zeus, said Sebes.
But if it departs from the body defiled and impure, I think, because it was always in the body's company, and tended it, and loved it, and was bewitched by it and by its desires and pleasures, so that it thought nothing was true except the bodily, the sort of thing one can touch and see and drink and eat and use for sex, while it had grown accustomed to hating and fearing and fleeing what's dark to the eyes and invisible, but intelligible and grasped by philosophy. Do you think a soul in that state will depart pure and by itself?
Not in the least, he said.
No, I think it will be thoroughly permeated by the bodily, which its constant company and intimacy with the body, through long practice, has made grow into it as though part of its nature.
Quite so.
And we should think of this element, my friend, as heavy and burdensome and earthy and visible. And it's this that weighs such a soul down and drags it back into the visible region, out of fear of the invisible and of Hades. So that, as the story goes, it hovers around graves and tombs, where indeed shadowy phantoms of souls have been seen. The sort of apparitions produced by souls that were not released purely but still cling to something of the visible, which is why they can be seen.
That's likely, Socrates.
Likely indeed, Sebes, and these certainly aren't the souls of the good, but of the base, forced to wander around such places, paying the penalty for their former bad upbringing. And they wander like that until, through desire for what accompanies them, their bodily element, they're bound once more into a body. And they're bound, naturally enough, into characters resembling whatever they practice during life.
What sort of thing do you mean by that, Socrates?
For instance, those who devoted themselves to gluttony and violence and drunkenness, without any restraint, are likely to slip into the bodies of donkeys and beasts of that kind.